The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Midgley. Jack is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting, based in Tokyo, Japan. And Jack, it's great to have you here back in D.C. Welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure, Roger.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to the conversation. Jack is a regular guest on the show, at least a couple times a year usually. Today we're going to talk about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook. And Jack played a key role in putting this together as Asia Pacific lead defense consulting in Tokyo for Deloitte Tohmatsu. And Jack, let's just start with the big picture. This is the fourth year that you guys have done this. Deloitte has done this survey, sort of study of the outlook of the top 50 countries.
That's right. We started this in 2013. This is our fourth annual global look.
Okay. So why don't we talk about some of the mechanics of it? It's always interesting to me. It's like, you know, you can talk about statistics and data and all that kind of stuff, but how do you guys go about sort of conducting the report, doing the analysis, and what are some of the things you look at? And then we can get into some of the interesting stuff that's in it.
Well, our perspective is economic and financial. We don't try to do military technical analysis. We aren't trying to make political statements about who's up and who's down. Rather, we're taking a hard look at the economic facts around defense spending, around how defense spending fits into national economies as an element of public policy, and what that really means in terms of national defense capability around the world. Our focus is on 50 countries. Those 50 countries spend about 95% of the $1.6 trillion that is spent globally on defense. And we think that focus helps our clients understand how different nations fit into the context of defense spending, where the opportunities are, where the risks are. And then we draw some broader statements, broader conclusions about where the key risks are that we see emerging in the world.
Right. And your clients, Deloitte's clients, can be actually governments, also private companies, just across the board.
Well, that's right. We serve ministries of defense across the world, and we also serve most of the defense prime contractors in the United States and worldwide.
Right. Well, yeah, it's and you mentioned you take a sort of economic look at, you know, defense and the profiles of the countries, and that sort of leads to, we can get right into it. You have various profiles and categories that you use to, I guess, not lump, but, you know, identify where people are, what countries are with regard to their spending versus GDP versus economic growth. Can you talk about those categories first?
Sure. We categorize countries according to their GDP and also to with respect to their total defense spending, because we see defense spending as part of a country's broader macroeconomic and fiscal policy. So we look at growth rates, both in terms of defense spending and the national economy. And when we do that, of course, we find that in every case for the top 50, defense spending is growing more slowly than national economies are growing. And that tells us that, first of all, countries are not technically militarizing. They aren't growing defense spending faster than the broader economy. It also tells us that the current rates of defense spending increases are probably sustainable for very long periods of time. And it also tells us that countries, as they grow, as they develop, tend to shift their spending away from defense into other types of investment, which shouldn't surprise. People want things other than defense. So social spending, infrastructure spending, and so forth tends to drive the rate of increase in defense spending down. And that's a trend that we're seeing across the world.
Is there some psychological? I mean, there's a couple of questions I have. Is there a psychological aspect of that? As you know, as economies grow and GDP grows, people also feel they want spending on other things, but they also maybe feel more secure as a group or not.
Well, I mean, psychoanalysis isn't really isn't our forte, but I can say that defense is generally seen as what economists call an inferior good, which means as you get richer, you spend a smaller share of your income on it. It's like life insurance. Yeah. You don't keep buying. Exactly. It's a form of insurance. So although, for example, countries like China are growing very rapidly, and therefore they're growing their defense budgets as they grow. But when you put it in context, in the broader context, you see that what China is really doing is growing its defense spending more slowly than it is growing its economy. Its primary attention is on infrastructure spending, social spending, other types of spending. Defense spending is being pulled upward as the economy grows.
Right. So like if they're spending whatever percent of what you tell me, what's the percent that China's spending on that GDP?
We think that they spend a little less than 2% of GDP.
But 2% of a pie that's ever growing means
exactly.
It looks like they're making these huge investments.
But and they are.
They
are making huge investments, but they're making huge investments that they can very well afford.
Yeah. In the case of China, when you look at it from an economic perspective too, is do you see, amongst other things that will continue to sort of limit, I guess, that, percentage of GDP, for example, making investments to address the environmental issues there. It seems to me that's something that has become a big concern there as well, and that will cost a lot of money.
It is going to cost a lot of money, and I think broadly what we can say is that other types of demand are likely to increase much faster than the demand for defense spending. That doesn't mean that China or the other states are going to cut defense spending or that their capabilities aren't immense. They are. It would be wrong, though, to say that there's any evidence to show that China is accelerating defense spending ahead of economic growth to sustain a kind of militaristic policy. There is no economic evidence to support that.
Okay. That's interesting stuff. Can you, for the listening audience, talk about the categories that you used in the report to identify, the spending behaviors of the various of the top 50 countries?
Yeah, we divide the top 50 up into a couple of different buckets based on the rate of economic growth and the growth in the defense budget. So we have a group of 14 countries that we call the high growth spenders. Those are countries that are growing economically at above the global rate and are also growing defense spending above 3%. Those are countries like Australia, China, India, and Poland. Poland, by the way, is the only one of the high growth spenders that's in Europe. That's one group
that's
of 14.
Just an observation, though. I wonder if next year you'll see a different place for Australia, given as an economy pretty commodity based, and with some of the dampening of demand for some of their raw materials and things like that.
Growth may slow a little bit in Australia. We're using World Bank projections to do this. Mm-hmm. I'd also point out that Australia is investing in defense very heavily. In fact, just this last week, the Australians announced that they had selected France as their international partner to build their next generation submarine.
Really?
So they've just bought basically the design for the short fin Barracuda, which is a nuclear submarine. The French are going to convert it into a conventional design. And Australia plans to build 8 to 12 submarines.
Wow.
That is the largest defense program in Australian history, around 50 billion Australian dollars over the next 30 years. It represents a huge commitment. But the interesting thing about the program is that in Australia, it's viewed primarily as an economic development program. So a lot of the debate around how big that program would be, who the international partner would be, has turned on the number and location of jobs that will be driven by the submarine construction.
Huh.
So the Prime Minister, when he announced the program, emphasized that it's going to be built, the subs are going to be built by DCNS in Australia. And he actually projected the number of jobs that are going to be driven by the new submarine program. So, you know, it kind of lines up with the idea that defense spending is both an element of national security policy and an element of national economic policy. In Australia, that is particularly important.
Wow. Yeah, and you know what, Jack? We're already at the first break. We didn't even get through the four categories. This is how interesting this stuff is. And, you know, when we come back, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about Australia and then go through the categories, because it's interesting to me, too, that one of the things that the report talks about is maritime commerce or transit, and whether this, you know, it's an economic investment from what you described, but also is it response to the, you know, the maritime traffic in the Asia Pacific region, and them looking to the future in that regard. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting out of Tokyo, Japan, and we're talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. He is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan, and we're talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook, the fourth in the reports that Deloitte has done on the Global Defense Outlook, taking an economic sort of perspective on it and what the top 50 countries in terms of defense spending are doing. And Jack, when we took the break, we got into a segue or a sidebar conversation sort of about Australia. And I just wanted to finish that and we can move on. And just because one of the questions that I had is, you talked about it's, you know, that it's in Australia, it's viewed as in part as a economic sort of development, you know, sustainment like activity or project. But also, I just was curious your thoughts, you know, given the amount of maritime traffic that goes through the Asia Pacific area, is it in part also, I mean, it's more than just that, right? It's partly a response to, you know, the amount of shipping that goes through that part of the world.
Well, it is. The Australians are absolutely convinced that they need to increase their naval presence because of the amount of Australian commerce that travels across the sea. So
it's replacing, a continent, but right, but it's a big island.
It's a big island, and you know, they're replacing the aging Collins class attack submarine fleet with this new generation of submarines, largely in response to the tremendous increase in maritime traffic in the South Pacific, and in response to the naval buildup that's happening with China, India, and the other Pacific states increasing their submarine fleets. So at the beginning of the Aussie submarine program, the deal was originally going to be between Australia and Japan. Japan was going to provide the Soryu-class submarine to Australia. Now, that deal didn't work out for commercial reasons.
And we may have talked about that on a previous show. I don't know.
I think we may have talked about that in the context of the Asia report.
Yeah.
But that's I think many people expected Japan to be selected, but for commercial reasons, that just didn't work out, and they went with the French French design. China was expressed publicly very severe concerns about the possibility of a naval lash up between Australia and Japan, and expressed a clear preference that the Australians should not select Japan as the as their international partner. So everybody's paying attention now to the scope and the direction of the naval buildup in the Pacific.
Yeah, and we'll maybe touch on that a little bit more in the show. So we've mentioned high growth spenders, then there's higher growth balancers in terms of a category, a profile of countries. I guess, can you just touch on those quickly? Because I want to get to to a new feature of your report on defense.
Well, sure. We identified nine high growth balancers, including Iran, Korea, Singapore, and Turkey. Those countries are growing their defense spending much slower than GDP, less than 3%. There's a group of 13 countries, including the UK, US, Japan, and Canada, that we call the economizers, where defense spending will be flat to declining. And then a few outliers, including Russia, where defense spending is dropping below 3%. over the next couple of years. So we start by kind of casting the top 50 defense spenders into those categories.
You have lenses for purposes of looking at the analysis.
That's right.
When I read the report, it was an interesting new feature. It's called the Defense Posture Index. So what is that, Jack? Can you talk about it for our listeners?
Well, our clients are interested in understanding how different countries view their overall commitment to national defense. And it's a hard thing to grasp. So what we've done is created a pretty straightforward quantitative index that basically ranks the top 50 countries on seven dimensions. They're economic, they're military, they're operational. So we look at the percent of GDP to defense. We look at the amount of the national labor force that's used for defense, the percent of gross government expenditures that are devoted to defense, whether the country has nuclear weapons, whether it's engaged in overseas conflicts, whether it's accepting battle-related deaths. Those dimensions are combined into a single number that we're using as a way to rank the total level of commitment to defense by the top 50 countries. And I think some of the results that came out of that attempt were interesting and surprising.
Yeah, well, can you talk a little bit about, to me, it's interesting that actually China's index score was below the average for the top 50. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, that's driven by the relatively low share of the defense of the labor force, the relatively low share of gross government expenses in China, and also by the fact that China is not engaged in combat operations outside its borders. So that contributed to a relatively low score for China. But I think one of the more counterintuitive findings of the index was that globally, over time, between 2010 and 2014, the global defense posture actually declined.
As a total.
As a global total.
Uh-huh.
And of the 50 countries that we looked at, only 9 increased their defense posture between 2010 and 2014. And those countries really only represent about 15% of the global defense budget. And only one of the increasers, France, was in Europe. 41 of the top 50 actually kept the defense posture flat or reduced it during that period. And those 41 include China, Russia, and the United States. Those countries represent 85% of global defense spending. So through the lens of the Defense Posture Index, what we're seeing is economic growth driving a reduced role for national defense in the economies of virtually every one of the top 50. That's the good news.
Uh-huh.
The not so good news is that economic development is also driving a set of what we call fault lines, where conflict appears to be increasingly likely. So we can say on the one hand, development is driving a reduced role for defense in the global economy. At the same time, it's also creating these new fault lines that make conflict
new
more
and
likely.
Old, sort of maybe, or new versions of some cases of old.
Some of them are old ones that are coming back to haunt us again.
Right. But and speaking of that, I wanted to ask you about Russia because they're one of the 41s where 41 you mentioned that where the profile
went down. That's right.
And I guess just thinking about current events. That is an average observer is sort of surprising when you look at what's been going on over the last couple of years, right? And now in Syria as well, where the Russians is there. Can you unpack that one a little bit? That's just fascinating to me.
Well, their operations in Ukraine and in Crimea and in Syria draw a lot of attention.
Yeah.
But the fact is that Russian defense spending is actually going down now that they've completed their recapitalization program. So Russian defense spending is going down. Now, they still have a very capable military. It's much more capable than it was at the end of the Cold War. So they're able to conduct operations that they were not able to conduct before. However, it's very difficult to paint the current Russian defense posture as one that is becoming
it's rising.
Is just not the case, and we think that the numbers support that conclusion very strongly.
Yeah, it's interesting that they have, I guess, to your point, they've completed their sort of recapitalization of their military.
Well, it dropped off a cliff in the post-Soviet period, and Putin made a very focused effort to rebuild. That program is continuing, but the spending that's associated with it has trailed off.
Right.
So,
is part of that too the economic, difficulties that Russia is having right now?
Most assuredly, yeah. They don't have the money that they did prior to sanctions, so that's driving it as well.
Right. Well, you mentioned fault lines, and this is a great segue because we were talking about Russia, but we can talk about all the fault lines a little bit, but let's start with the Russia-NATO one that the report identifies.
Well, we looked at five emerging global fault lines. These are places where economic and defense pressures are creating the potential for conflict. And in the, I think it's well understood that NATO and Russia are squaring off now in ways that are different from the way they were dealing with each other a few years ago. So in the most recent defense budget, the U.S. proposes a several billion dollar increase in the allocation for Europe. That's the European Reassurance Initiative, or ERI. Which is actually going to put an additional armored brigade into Poland. It's continuing with the anti-missile system development and deployment and some other spending, including a division headquarters and so forth. So, but the fact is that NATO's eastern edge has moved much closer. So the opportunity for conflict, the opportunity for an accidental confrontation is increasing. And we saw that in recent days with the flyby of an American destroyer by Russian aircraft.
Right.
This is taking place in a context where the old confidence-building measures, the old arms control measures that kept NATO and the Warsaw Pact apart have been allowed to deteriorate. So we have economic development driving NATO to the east. We have an increasingly capable set of military forces, and we have a reduced ability to manage conflict because of the decline in these traditional confidence-building measures.
Right.
So very recently, the NATO Secretary General has suggested that to address this fault line, we need to reopen the Vienna document. We need to be thinking more in terms of confidence-building measures again, and I hope that will happen.
Yeah.
But this fault line is emerging very clearly.
Yeah, and I got a question for you about that, too, when we come back. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting, Tokyo, Japan. Today, we're talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook, the report. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Jack a little bit about any thoughts on this particular fault line for whoever is our next president. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. He is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting out of Tokyo, Japan. And today, we are talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook. Jack played a big role in helping put that report together. And so, Jack, when we took the break, we were talking about that Russia-NATO sort of fault line and how it's sort of reemerged in a different way, and you raised some interesting and important observations about the breakdown in like old measures in terms of communication, or even like checks and balance, safety checks that during the Cold War kept things cold, right? It'd be interesting to get your thoughts as this as we continue down this road, is that we're having an election here in November, and somebody's going to be our next president, somebody different. You have any thoughts on in this area what that next president ought to be thinking about? Is that a fair question for you? It's a big question.
Yeah, it is. It is a big question, but I think it's an important one. during the Cold War, both sides paid enormous attention to trying to avoid the prospect of accidental conflict. And it was easier then because the buffer between NATO and Russia, there was a huge buffer provided by the territory of the Warsaw Pact.
Yeah.
So American and Russian forces didn't confront each other directly. Now, with the enlargement of NATO, the addition of Poland, the addition of the Baltic states, the prospect of an accidental confrontation is much higher. Forces are much, they move faster, they're more capable, they're more dangerous. And we still have the Article 5 issue. So an attack on any NATO member,
right,
including Lithuania or Poland, is supposed to be treated exactly the same as an attack on all the members of NATO, including the United States. Well, in that Article 5 context, that means that the threat of a very high order conflict, including nuclear conflict, is a political and military reality. Well, if that's true, then our next president, as our current president has tried, has to be focused on putting measures in place that minimize the risk of accidental or inadvertent conflict. So military to military exchanges, early warning, close communication protocols, all of those military technical measures that allow forces to operate in close proximity and in relative safety have to be reexamined and, I think, put back in place. That's not very those aren't very flashy or
right.
Okay. Exciting.
Sexy, right, yeah.
That's very, you know, mundane kind right. of military
but
technical
it's fundamental.
Work has to be done.
Yeah. Really interesting. So let's talk about the China-Pacific fault line for a minute or two. Just what is that from, and what does it sort of mean? Again, I guess we can put it through a prism of the United States. What does it mean?
Well, we come back to the economic facts of life. The amount of world trade that has moves now through the South Pacific, through the South China Sea, has more than tripled over the last 10 years. It's going to continue to increase. China's share, China's dependence on sea-based commerce is growing by the day. So the amount of container traffic that moves through that area is immense and it's valuable. That means that navies are going to protect that commerce. So what's happening in the South China Sea and in the South Pacific is an enormous program of naval construction.
We mentioned Australia. We talked
Australia,
about
but also India. China is going to build 30 new submarines. China, as everyone understands, is doing island reclamation projects in the Spratlys, and it's going to continue to do that as it has the right to do. Just as we talked about, though, in Europe, what we have in the South Pacific, South China Sea, is increasingly capable military organizations operating in very close proximity to each other. And what we think has been I won't say neglected, but not optimized, is the development of confidence-building measures and treaty mechanisms that allow these forces to operate with some level of confidence. What I think everyone has an interest in avoiding is accidental conflict resulting from these naval vessels operating and making mistakes. And in Asia, unlike in Europe, the political structures, the treaty structures aren't in place. So the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, the ASEAN mechanisms, none of this is able to address deconflicting or separating these very capable naval forces. That's a real problem. And I think to go back to your earlier question, the next administration and global leaders in the region are going to have to address how do we keep these forces apart? Because they are going to continue to operate, and the naval
environment—even more, the tempo will be even greater in terms of
the tempo goes
right?
up. Yeah, yeah. And I beating up China about putting an airstrip in the Spratlys doesn't really get us anywhere, since there is no treaty or international law that they're violating by putting that airstrip up. The real question is, given that they're changing the facts on the ground, how do we make sure that there is not an accidental conflict between U.S. Navy units, for example, mm-hmm. exercising freedom of navigation, and Chinese naval units operating virtually side by side. That's very dangerous, and it's a situation that can best be addressed by diplomatic and other measures, not by direct military measures.
Right. So, and from a from China's perspective, so you have the United States, you know, and its navy, Australia is making investments, and then India. That's why I wanted to ask you about. They're making big investments in their navy as well.
Well, among other things, a second aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
A huge submarine construction program. Yes, Indian Navy intends to operate, as it should, has to be able to operate in a way that defends the Indian interest in freedom of navigation for Indian Ocean commerce. That's to be expected.
Right.
And in the absence of arms control or other treaty mechanisms, these forces are going to continue to bump into each other. That's what we think constitutes the fault line.
It creates just an increasingly complex set of on the ground, real on the sea, let's say, mm-hmm. real life factors that, you know, that's just from a Chinese perspective, you know, you've got the Indian Navy over here. You've got, you have the United States Navy, Japan, you know, Australia. It seems like it's, I don't know what I'm struggling with, but it just seems very, very complicated with so many different moving parts.
Well, it's the Wild West, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the thrust of the naval construction effort is undersea operations.
Mm-hmm.
And those operations are marked by stealth. So you've now we're moving toward a naval environment in the Pacific where we have very capable manned and unmanned submarine forces that can run into each other.
Yeah.
And it's just on its face, it's uncomfortable to contemplate that situation in an unregulated environment. It's just inherently dangerous because those units, those vessels are very capable, they're very stealthy, and the risk of accidental confrontation is very high.
Right. Well, for the United States, so you mentioned China's building 30 submarines.
30 submarines.
We've talked about Australia. So India's got a big program. What the United States sort of has an installed base, I guess, of subs.
We're doing a lot more than that.
What are we doing? That's more where I was going
to go. The FY17 budget that Secretary Carter testified on just recently includes 5 new Virginia-class submarines. It includes heavy investment in unmanned undersea mm-hmm. vehicles. It includes investment in a new heavy torpedo. So we're making very substantial commitments to undersea operations with the view toward the Chinese naval development.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're already up on the break. Jack, when we come back, I'd like to talk about a couple other fault lines or areas of interest in the report to me and hopefully to our listeners, terrorism and then also cyber. Some interesting information in the report with regard to cyber. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan, and we are talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. We're fortunate enough to have him in studio here today talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook. And Jack, when we took the break, mentioned a couple other fault lines, areas I'd like to cover. We got 10 minutes left. We could do 2 or 3 shows here with all the information that's in this report. But a couple of fault lines. But in the first one I'd like to talk about is terrorism. It just really, where are we with it with regard to the fault line? What does it mean? And again, can that prism of what does the next president need to think about? I think that's a great, very relevant sort of thought.
Well, from our perspective, the data suggests that the war on terrorism isn't going very well. And we looked at, there were two indicators that really brought this home for us. One is we compared the number of terrorist incidents between 2005-2007 with 2012-2014. During that period, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars been spent by a whole coalition of countries to fight terrorism. However, in the Middle East, a 300% increase in the number of terrorist incidents in between those two periods. In South Asia, more than 400%. And in sub-Saharan Africa, more than 800% increase in the number of terrorist incidents. That's not evidence of a successful war on terror. But what we were particularly troubled by is the increase in what we call persistent terrorist groups. A lot of terrorism happens when individuals or ad hoc groups launch a single attack and then they disappear. That's one kind of problem. But what we notice is that the number of groups that are able to mount multiple attacks in multiple years is increasing. That suggests that the terrorists are becoming more organized and more capable despite our efforts in counterterrorism. And the numbers here were really very stark. The number of persistent groups in 2005-2007, that number was 72. 72 groups were able to carry out multiple attacks in Africa, Middle East, and South Asia. Between 2012 and 2014, that number doubled, 144.
Wow.
That's very troubling because it suggests an organizational capability that is going to allow these groups to continue to operate. Now, the spectacular attacks, the high-profile attacks in
like
Europe,
Paris, Brussels.
They get a lot of press. Right. They get a lot of attention. But the attacks that we don't tend to see in the Western press that are happening daily in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world are creating this undertone, this drumbeat of insecurity that's driving migration. It's driving instability in African governments and in Middle Eastern governments, and it's increasingly, we think, a global problem. So, the total increase in terrorism, combined with the increase in persistent terrorist groups, we found to be a very troubling set of trends.
Yeah, you take my breath away here on the description and what the data tells us. Do you have any thoughts on, or lessons learned? Let's say just like lessons learned from the last, 4 or 5 years, and or even that. What's about 9 years, right? Difference between your initial set of data and your comparison that you did to the last 3 years or so, and all the investments that have been made. We're clearly something's not going right, right? So do you have any thoughts on where we ought to go?
Well, maybe to get back to your earlier theme, with the change in administration, maybe it would be useful to take a hard look at the tactics that we're using to combat terrorist groups. On its face, it would appear that simply is not working. And whether that means we need to take a more economic or more diplomatic approach, whether that means we need to simply acknowledge that this problem is going to be with us for a while is not clear. There's no prescription that emerges from the data, but it is very clear that what we've been doing is not working.
Yeah, and is that part of it? You mentioned too is that they're better, right? They're better organized.
They're better organized. They're better equipped.
They communicate and more sophisticated in their approaches.
Well, and in a way, the technology that we find so useful is also enabling these groups.
Yeah.
For example, Facebook is now being used to buy and sell military equipment within and among these terrorist groups. There was a study published just about a month ago. That showed that anti-tank systems, communication systems, heavy weapons are all being bought and sold using Facebook.
Wow.
That's a remarkable change because it allows arms trafficking to happen completely outside the normal regulatory or control measures that we think of in the West. So the technology that makes our lives better mm-hmm. is also enabling terrorist organizations to mount very sophisticated military threats.
Right. Well, and it's sort of a good segue to the next topic, and that's cyber. There can be cyber terrorism too. Didn't they shut down a electric grid or something in New York, or at least hacked into it? I can't remember where that originated from, but that's part of the threat from terrorism as well. But can you talk about the cyber threat and also, how some of these top 50 countries are positioned to either defend against or, launch, for lack of a better term?
Well, we try to understand vulnerability to cyber attack by looking mm-hmm. at the relative dependence of the top 50 countries, their economic dependence on the internet. And what we found was a difference of 6 to 10 times between the vulnerability of the most internet-enabled nations, like mm-hmm. Korea, Denmark, and the least internet-enabled nations, which tend to be the extractive economies of the Middle East, where commerce is just not that internet-dependent. So there's a huge disparity between national economies in terms of cyber risk. The U.S. is actually kind of in the middle of the pack because the U.S. economy is very diversified. It's not as completely information dependent as, for example, South Korea or Denmark.
That's immediately who come to mind. South Korea.
So, what that's doing is creating a gap that can be exploited by countries that are less exposed to the internet, and I would include there, for example, the Iranians, but also the Chinese.
The Russians?
And certainly the Russians.
Yeah.
And the countries, especially in Western Europe, that are very, very heavily internet dependent. So that suggests to us that the likelihood of cyber attack against those developed economies is very high, because the consequences are low.
There's cyber version of mutual assured destruction, right?
There is no cyber equivalent today of mutual assured destruction. So to us, what that suggests is that the more advanced countries need to think differently about cyber strategy. They can't just be thinking in terms of proportionate response in cyberspace. They have to think about other measures, whether that's economic sanctions or military measures to counter cyber attack. So we looked at the overall vulnerability, but we also wanted to understand how the Internet of Things mm-hmm. Is creating new kinds of exposure. So we just took a look at the industrial control systems and the relative exposure of national economies to industrial control system attacks, like attacks against the power grid or other infrastructure. And we found the same pattern. The extractive economies of the Middle East don't depend much on industrial control systems that are exposed to the internet, but the Western economies really do.
Yeah.
And that difference in vulnerability is growing year by year, and it suggests that there are opportunities for attack. Now, our analysis just looked at gross vulnerability. It did not take into account the sophisticated countermeasures that advanced countries are also able to deploy. All we did was count targets.
Right.
But when you count targets, the story looks very troubling.
Yeah. It's interesting. With counting targets, and also even within there, some targets are, to your point, there'll be some sophisticated defense measures. But in other cases, different sectors might be more vulnerable than others within an economy. When you talk the United States economy being diversified, so it's actually sort of in the middle of the pack. But within that, there could be some high areas of vulnerability for the United States in certain parts of our economy, theoretically, right?
That's certainly true.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we have about a minute left. I wanted to give you a chance to sort of address the big takeaway from this report this year, what you would want to emphasize when folks, and I do commend people take a look at this. It's a great report. you know, the big trend, or is there a big trend? Maybe the big trend is that there are many different trends impacting.
Well, there is. There's a big trend that comes away from this, and that is that overall, the world is becoming less dependent on military spending and national defense spending than it has ever been. And economic development is driving that forward. That's a very good news story. At the same time, those economic and technical improvements in the world are creating vulnerability, and in the five areas that we talked about.
The fault lines.
And what was interesting to us was that in every one of those five areas, it appears that diplomatic initiatives, treaty initiatives, economic initiatives are going to be key to reducing the threat to world security. Many people say, you know, the war on terror and so forth, it can't be resolved by military measures alone. That certainly appears to be true.
Yeah.
And we think that if you look at the totality of our report this year, it really underscores the importance of diplomatic and political measures to reduce the risk along these five fault lines.
Great. Jack, as always, great show. Thank you so much. My guest today has been Jack Midgley. He is with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And we've been talking about Deloitte's 2016 Global Defense Outlook. Thanks for listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.